Welcome to Shifting Mindsets for Better Health, a podcast series produced by our partners at Central Michigan University with a grant from the Children's Foundation. COVID-19 has impacted the lives of millions. Sharing information among healthcare professionals is going to be key to saving lives and improving outcomes. This podcast series brings together healthcare professionals across disciplines to share insight into the far-reaching effects this pandemic has on children, caretakers, and medical care providers.
The best way to protect young children who can't get vaccinated is to get everyone in the community vaccinated.
Don't give up, because obviously this virus is not giving up.
This episode is variants, vaccines, and post-COVID conditions in children. The COVID-19 pandemic has been a race against the spreading SARS-CoV-2 virus and its variants, and getting populations to herd immunity with vaccines. This podcast was recorded in September 2021. Currently, there are 3 vaccines being administered in the United States to adults. 2 are messenger RNA vaccines produced by Pfizer and Moderna, and were authorized by the FDA for emergency use in December 2020. The other is a viral vector vaccine produced by Johnson & Johnson, which was authorized for emergency use in February 2021. As this podcast is released, the Pfizer vaccine has received full approval for use in adults. The COVID-19 vaccine for children has not moved as quickly. The Pfizer vaccine was authorized for emergency use in children 12 years and older in May 2021. Currently, in September 2021, the Pfizer vaccine is the only one the FDA has authorized for emergency use in children. Dr. Joycelyn Eng is a pediatric disease specialist at Children's Hospital of Michigan and a professor of pediatrics at CMU's College of Medicine. Dr. Eng explains the current trials to find vaccines suitable for children of all ages.
Currently, we have 2 vaccine manufacturers, the Pfizer BioNTech and Moderna, and both are conducting trials in healthy children between the ages of 6 months and 11 years of age. Studies on children are needed, and children may have different reactions to vaccination, so we cannot extrapolate the data that we have from older adults into children. These trials started in March of this year. First, the Pfizer-BioNTech mRNA vaccine. They are doing phase 1 and phase 2 and 3 studies. The phase 1 study is a dose-finding study. They are doing these in ages 6 months to 11 years. And the purpose of the phase 1 study is to identify the preferred dose level of vaccine from up to 3 different dose levels in each of the age groups. After they have the selected dose level from phase 1, they will move on to the phase 2 and 3 of the trial, which is the placebo-controlled observer-blinded study, and this will evaluate the safety, tolerability, and immunogenicity in each of the age groups. And they are planning about 4,600 participants in this study. So that's the Pfizer-BioNTech mRNA vaccine trial in children. Another vaccine is the Moderna mRNA vaccine. Currently, this vaccine is approved for use in persons 18 years and older. They have recently applied for emergency use authorization for use in children ages 12 to 18 years, and they're awaiting FDA approval. So for the current studies, similar to Pfizer vaccine, they're doing the dose-finding studies for the young children 6 months to 11 years of age. In this Moderna trial, it's a phase 2 and 3 study consisting of 2 parts. The first part is an open-label dose-finding study. And depending on the age groups, patients may receive up to 3 different dose levels. After the first part is completed, an interim analysis will be conducted to determine which dose will be used in their part 2 of the study, which is the placebo-controlled expansion portion of the study. And this is a randomized, observer-blind, placebo-controlled study and will evaluate the safety, tolerability, reactogenicity, Reactogenicity means local and systemic reaction. And effectiveness of the two-dose mRNA vaccine still given at the same interval, 28 days apart. The company intends to enroll approximately 6,750 pediatric participants in US and Canada, 6 months to less than 12 years of age. So these are the two vaccines that are currently underway in children in the United States.
All of the COVID-19 vaccines began use in the United States under an emergency use authorization from the FDA. Dr. Ang explains what this is and the process for granting this type of use.
What is an emergency use authorization? That's a question, EUA, right? So while technically a vaccine needs to have FDA approval before the public can receive it, traditionally it's called the licensure. But because COVID-19 is considered a public health emergency, vaccine manufacturers can choose to submit a request for an EUA. Once submitted, the FDA will evaluate the EUA request and determine whether the relevant statutory criteria are met, taking into account the totality of the scientific evidence about the vaccine that is available to FDA. This EUA is a mechanism to facilitate the availability and use of the medical countermeasures, including vaccine, drugs, during public health emergencies, such as the COVID-19 pandemic. So this is just to facilitate the availability of these products to the public. Pfizer is the only vaccine that is approved under the FDA EUA for ages 12 and older. This was just granted by the FDA and CDC in May of this year. Most of the concerns from parents are how safe and effective these vaccines are, being that there is a perception that the vaccines under EUA were rushed and not studied carefully. To overcome this concern, we need to educate parents and make them understand the FDA vaccine approval process under EUA. We have to assure them that although these vaccines may be approved through an EUA, it still utilizes standards much closer to that of an actual biologic license application, BLA. We have to take them through the vaccine approval process, which I will summarize. Once phase 3 data became available, the company will submit an application to FDA for an EUA. The FDA will then begin a review of the application. So who in FDA are reviewing these? The FDA has a committee. I'm sure people have heard of this committee, the Vaccine and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, the VRBPAC. So these are the FDA career scientists in the committee. They will review the application and they will hold the meeting and advise FDA to come to this determination of whether the FDA should grant an EUA. The VRBPAC will review and evaluate the data concerning the safety, effectiveness, and appropriate use of the vaccine candidate. So this is the FDA. And then another committee, the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices of the CDC, ACIP, will also review after an EUA is submitted. So ACIP will hold an emergency meeting with public comment sessions. This is open to public to review the safety and efficacy data. And then they will vote on recommendations for the vaccine and prioritization of vaccine within the populations. And then they will submit the recommendation to the CDC director. As you can see, the data will be thoroughly reviewed by the FDA VRBPAC as well as the CDC ACIP prior to the vaccines being administered under the EUA. So it is not a process that is rushed.
As this podcast is being produced, the FDA has granted the Pfizer vaccine full approval for use in adults, but it is still under emergency use authorization for children 12 years and older. The Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines are still under emergency use authorization for adults. At the end of August 2021, around 60% of Americans 12 years or older were fully vaccinated. In Michigan, 55% were fully vaccinated, which is 10% more than were vaccinated at the beginning of the summer. Dr. Delisha Pruitt is an associate professor of family medicine in the CMU College of Medicine and is the medical director for the Saginaw County Health Department. Dr. Pruitt continues to encourage vaccination for people who are resistant.
Vaccine confidence and hesitancy is affecting the vaccination rates. If you see earlier on, we were vaccinating a lot of people and there was high demand, scarce resources, right? And now we're starting to have increasing resources and less demands because the people who really wanted it actually got the vaccine. And the people who are kind of skeptical or hesitant, they are not flocking towards the vaccine as we would like. So we have some vaccine clinics across our health systems that are not fully utilized because there are not enough people to sign up for the vaccine now. So with our vaccines, it's like an invisible shield. You don't know necessarily, I might not have gotten COVID-19 even if I didn't get the vaccine, correct? And so a lot of times people have this idea of, I got it, but I don't even know if it works. One of the things about prevention is, you never know that it's done until something happens, right? And so this is what's hard about public health in general. The job of public health is to prevent major things from happening. And so if it's working well, you never know anything is done. That's the power of prevention. Why is that a big deal? Well, it's a big deal because for the people who hadn't had the prevention or somehow missed the prevention, then they actually got COVID-19, and though some of those people actually died. Some of those people are the long haulers who have long-term side effects. And so what you wanna do is, you may never see COVID-19 because you got the vaccine. But isn't that what prevention is? It's blocking something bad from happening. So logically you say, if I don't want the bad thing to happen, I have to prevent the bad thing from happening. So I think it's really important to say, maybe you don't ever get COVID-19 because you got the vaccine. I think that's a good thing. That's what you want. I mean, we could all have a herd immunity if everybody got the natural infection at the same time, but this is not how this virus works because it takes 2 weeks for us to start showing symptoms. We're slowly but surely infecting everybody as we go. So the best way to get herd immunity, the best way is to do it the vaccination way, because multiple people can be vaccinated at the same time, and then we all have the immunity all at the same time. That's the way to protect those 25 to 30% of people who we hope will get the vaccine, who probably won't get the vaccine.
Dr. Pruitt describes the public health issues with the spread of the COVID-19 virus.
One of the things about COVID-19, which is so interesting, is that it takes 2 to 14 days for COVID-19 to incubate in our system and for us to start having symptoms, which means that I could be around you and transmit it and have no symptoms at all because I'm early in the disease state, right? And so this is the uniqueness of this virus, which allows it to spread more easily among people because the person you're next to, Barb looks great. She doesn't look sick, but yet she can have contact with multiple people and give COVID-19 to multiple people. That's why we have to be very vigilant about wearing our mask. You know, when we talk about close contact is less than 6 feet for 15 or more minutes. And so they changed the definition sometime in the middle of all of this, where the time is cumulative. So you can be next to someone for 2 minutes and then leave and come back for 3 more minutes. And then it all adds up to 15 minutes. So that's why we have to just be vigilant and wear a mask, because the first thing we talk to people when we do contact tracing, how long were you next to that person? We ask them. And people always want to say less than 15 minutes because they know that's the diagnostic criteria, right? But you never know, because you don't think about how long I stood next to my grandmother or my daughter or whomever, because you're not thinking about that. And so we need to wear our mask and watch our distance.
One of the consequences of a spreading virus is variants.
The variants are very important, and how they are different is a virus replicates itself. And in replication, it makes a small replication error. And that little error can change a virus shape or function. So with COVID-19, I don't know if you guys have seen the picture, it's kind of round and it has those little spikes all around it. And it kind of looks like a crown. That's why they call it corona, which is crown-like. Well, when you have that replication error and then you have a mutation, what happens is that spike changes just a little bit on the protein. When the antibodies come, that's your body system trying to come and fight against this coronavirus. What it does is it recognizes it and then comes and attaches onto that spike protein. The problem is it can't attach well because it's a little bit different spike protein. It can become more contagious because the body doesn't fight well against it. A vaccine might not work well against one form of the variant versus another because of those small little differences in the replication areas. Then you get the mutation. And this is how viruses last for a very long time, like the common cold. You know, it never really goes away, right? Everybody gets a cold and you can get a different one because it constantly is changing. And so the flu is like that every year. We kind of estimate what flu vaccine we'll use based on what happens in Australia. And then you make a vaccine here. And some years it's a good vaccine and some years is not based on our guesstimation. And so right now, some of our vaccines may work well against one variant and may not work so well against another. And so that's what is being researched right now because of these different small replication errors causes big enough changes where you might not be able to fight against one form of COVID-19 versus another.
Currently, the Delta variant of the COVID-19 virus is proving to be more contagious than other variants. It also may be associated with more health issues. Dr. Ang also promotes vaccination.
The current vaccine is safe and effective, and that they should also take into consideration the rapid spread of the highly contagious variants that are circulating, the Delta variant. And we know that the Delta variant is highly contagious, and it accounts for about 58% of all the COVID cases in the U.S. right now. So that means that anyone who is unvaccinated is at a higher risk of contracting this variant. A safe and effective vaccine will be an important tool to stop the spread of this virus. We don't know yet whether the variant causes more severe disease than the usual variant. We don't know that yet. Most of our children do recover completely from this infection. But as you've heard, some patients who have been infected have new recurring or ongoing symptoms, also clinical findings 4 or more weeks after their initial infection. And sometimes these symptoms appear after an initial symptom recovery. So these post-COVID conditions are being referred to by a wide range of names, including long COVID, long haul COVID, post-acute COVID, etc. The incidence of long-term complications of COVID-19 in children is limited. We don't know the incidence. In the UK, a report showed that about 12 to 15% of children with both symptomatic and asymptomatic COVID-19 are experiencing long-term effects weeks after their initial infection. And we still don't know the causes of long COVID symptoms. It affects survivors of all age group and at all level of severity, including those that were physically healthy before the infection. And they've also reported lingering symptoms weeks after acute illness. The range of these long-term effects of children are what we think the same as in adults. And they can include a variety of non-specific symptoms such as fatigue, headache, shortness of breath, brain fog, GI symptoms, anxiety, depression, etc. And these symptoms can be disabling. We know that we need to do research to understand these conditions. So NIH has launched a new initiative to study long COVID, and these will include opportunities focusing on clinical trials to study the risk factors associated with post-COVID and the strategies to treat these long-term symptoms and promoting recovery from infection. I want to say that management of these patients are difficult and they will require multidisciplinary approach and coordination of care with multiple pediatric subspecialists, such as peds pulmonology, cardiology, physical rehab and medicine is important. Also, psychology, neurology, and ENT when needed. Regarding the long-term MISC complications, MISC is different. MISC is a post-infectious inflammatory syndrome associated with COVID in children. In children with MISC, they can develop heart inflammation with significantly impaired left ventricular function. That's the main complication and outcome that we're monitoring. While most patients recover and are doing well on follow-up, we did a study in our institution and found that a small proportion, 19% of our patients, continue to have abnormal left ventricular strain seen on 2D echo, even though they're clinically fine, which may indicate subclinical left ventricular dysfunction. This group of patients, although again clinically asymptomatic at follow-up, our cardiology group is monitoring them very carefully to ensure that they have no long-term cardiac sequelae. So overall, we still do not know the long-term effects of MISC on the heart and on other organ system. That's why there is a clinical trial across the country to look at the short and long-term effects of MISC in the U.S., and we are one of the participating centers.
Multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, or MISC or MISC, was covered in an earlier episode of Shifting Mindsets for Better Health, entitled Physical Health and COVID-19 in Children. The COVID-19 virus can cause death, and in some patients, lasting side effects. But the vaccines also have side effects. One is myocarditis, inflammation of the middle layer of the heart wall. Dr. Ang addresses this.
The myocarditis is associated side effect of the mRNA vaccines. So it's both the Pfizer and Moderna. But because Pfizer is authorized for use in children 12 to 15 years of age, we are seeing more reports of myocarditis associated with the Pfizer vaccine, but it's associated with both mRNA vaccine. And most cases of myocarditis are in males aged 12 to 39 years old. And it's noted that most cases were mild and self-limited, and they improved within several days. No fatalities were reported. So CDC came up with an estimate within this age group of 12 to 39 years of age in males, they estimated that myocarditis occurred at a rate of 12.6 cases per million second doses that are given, and typically within several days after COVID-19 vaccination. How do we put this risk in perspective? Because any potential adverse events following vaccination must be weighed against the individual and the risk of withholding vaccination. So I think the cases of myocarditis associated with the vaccine tend to be mild and self-resolving. And if we do not vaccinate, we're taking chances of getting COVID infection. This is worse than with the rare side effects of the vaccine, as the actual infection with the virus can also cause heart inflammation and other organ damage, along with the post-infectious complications of MISC, which can also affect the heart. So weighing the pandemic's physical and social emotional harms to our children against this rare mild episode of myocarditis potentially associated with the vaccine, the benefit of vaccination still outweighs the risk of myocarditis.
Dr. Ang provides some concluding remarks.
Despite the initial decreasing rates of COVID-19, the disease is now increasing. And the current circulating Delta variant is highly contagious. So early and effective vaccination reduces ongoing variant transmission. And we know that 99.9% of new hospitalizations from COVID-19 are from people who have not yet received the vaccine. Some children and many adults are still getting very sick, and some are even dying. So right now, the best way to protect young children who can't get vaccinated is to get everyone in the community vaccinated. And regarding our children, while it's true that young children are less likely to become ill from COVID-19, there is still a chance that they can get ill. So children of all ages can get sick from COVID. They can be admitted to the hospital and end up in the ICU. And those with underlying comorbidities can die from the disease and its complications. We are still learning about the spectrum of COVID-19 in children, and it appears that there are also those with lingering symptoms of post-COVID with significant long-term sequelae. So when the vaccine becomes available, parents should get their children vaccinated, because a safe and effective vaccine for children is an important tool in stopping the spread of COVID-19.
Thank you to Drs. Joycelyn Ang and Alicia Pruitt for sharing their expertise in variants, vaccines, and post-COVID conditions in children. To find out about our other podcasts, go to med.cmich.edu/shiftingmindsets. The Shifting Mindsets for Better Health podcast series is a production of the College of the Arts and Media, the College of Medicine, and the Interdisciplinary Center for Community Health and Wellness at Central Michigan University. Executive producer and host is Dr. Heather Polinsky. Interview recording and editing by Mr. Michael Potter. Produced by Drs. Judy Blabia, Allison Arnold, and John Lowry. Funded by a grant from the Children's Foundation.